This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala ashrafil anbiya wal mursaleen. Muhammad wa rasulullahi sallallahu alayhi wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam tasliman kathiran kathira. Fama ba'du. My brothers and sisters, sometime a couple of days ago I said that Islam was not sent to be taught academically but sent to be taught practically. And that is the whole secret of the power of Islam as Rasulullah ﷺ taught it and what has happened to it since then when we have been now trying to teach Islam in a way that has literally which is exactly the same as we teach any other subject in our schools, which is academically, and then we test the students' memories, really, because we are not testing knowledge, we are not testing their understanding, we are not, you know, by any means testing their application of the religion, whether they can apply it in their lives or not. We're just testing how much of what we fed them, the data, information, how much of that do they retain and how much of that can they regurgitate on the day of the exam, which is completely useless. Having said that, is it necessary to assess the effectiveness of teaching and the depth of learning and the ability to use the knowledge that was imparted? Of course, to know that is critical, both for our own ongoing modification if necessary of our teaching methods, and to ensure that at the end of the day, having spent all the time and energy and effort teaching something, that it results in something beneficial because people can actually apply it. Now, this is where we fall apart. Now, the reason for that is that this is a very time-consuming and a very one-on-one, physically demanding task in that sense. And that is why this terminology, when we say it takes a whole village to raise a child, we like to bandy about these statements. I ask myself, do we really understand half the stuff we talk about? My guess is we don't. So when we say it needs a whole village, did we ask ourselves, why do you need a whole village? Right? Because we have a education system where not only do we not have a whole village for one child, we have the entire village being taught by one person, because this is our schooling system. Our schooling system is that each class has 15, 20, 30, 40, in India at least I know 50, 60 students and one single teacher. So now on the other hand, you're saying that you need a whole village to teach one child. The reason is the difference of that. When you have a whole village teaching one child, you create a certain level and quality of product. When you have 30, 40, 50, 60 children in one class with one teacher, you create a different quality of product. The reason you need so many people is because at the end of the day, when you are looking at the issue of inculcating values, the way you measure that, whether these values have been inculcated or not, is by physically seeing, monitoring action. How do I know if values have been imbibed? By seeing what people do, what the student is doing on a day-to-day basis. So, if, for example, if I'm teaching the value of honesty and integrity, then I have to I have to see whether the value that I taught, which is honesty and integrity, whether the child is actually practicing honesty or not. Now, there is no way of doing that apart from monitoring that child 24/7. There is no way that any individual teacher is going to be able to do that, even for one child. So, what do you need? You need multiple teachers who are monitoring that child. And we are not looking at some kind of police state where you have, you know, people watching you all the time. But you're looking at a situation where, in the most natural way, in the most kind way, in the most compassionate way, the child is being, within quotes, monitored and course corrected as the case might be. Now, this, forget about the ancient past, even when I was growing up, I grew up in a joint family, we lived in a vast house with all aunts and uncles and so on. And nobody had to spell out these rules. The basic rule was that any adult had the right to, and did that in a very nice way, correct me if I was doing anything wrong. Could be anybody. Aunts, uncles, grandparents, grandparents, brothers and sisters, so they were grandparents, but like cousin grandparents, and including, because we had a whole bunch of in-house servants who lived in the house, those servants. So these were not related to us, these were actually servants, but they were treated with respect. We had to treat them with respect. You didn't call them by name, for example. You called them you called them uncle or auntie or something. And if you did something wrong, and one of those servants saw that, they would correct you. Now, this included, never happened to me, but included, for example, this included a person, an adult, including a servant, slapping you on the wrist, for example, or giving you a whack on your behind if you were completely out of line. Now, obviously, nobody brutalized any of us. Nobody was beating us up and so on. But there was corporal punishment in that way, not causing injury, but definitely, an adult had the right to correct you, both by word or by action. And this was, and if the parents came to know that this happened, they would be thankful and they would express their thanks to the adult who corrected you and say, thank you very much for looking out for my son or daughter. The second thing was that if you went and complained as a child, if say an uncle of mine corrected me on something and this correction comprised of, a whack on my behind, and if I went and complained to my father, I would get a second whack on my behind for complaining, right? I'd get two whacks, one for complaining and one to reinforce the whack that my uncle gave me. So, the point here was that this supervision, one-on-one attention to each child, was possible because there were a whole lot of adults involved in the care of one child. All family members, related, even unrelated, servants and so on, were concerned about this one person, one child, and they were interested in that person's welfare. And this happened in a very normal, matter-of-fact way. It wasn't in a class and so on, but it happened. You know, the example of this I always think about is the way elephants bring up their young. An elephant calf is an extremely valuable member of the herd because the elephants have a huge gestation period, very long gestation period, and then the delivery of the calf is very difficult. So therefore, the calf is hugely, hugely valuable. The elephants will not just let a calf go. So the whole herd takes care of the calf. The calf is in the center of the herd. The calf has a ball. The nicest childhood in the world is the childhood of an elephant calf. He is completely secure. He is taken care of by his mother and by what in our language we call aunts. So these are, they're all related because the whole herd is related. But they are closer and more distant relatives. They would be, could be older siblings, could be siblings from a different brood, different generation. Also would be literally the aunts, the sisters of the mother, and including sometimes the herd bulls. They would all look after that one calf. Now again, they would look after the calf if he was taking any risk. They would, you know, look out for him. They would allow him also to take certain risks. They will not completely protect him because they want him to learn. So they let him do something, but they let him do that within the purview of safety. They did not let the calf, they don't let the calf take risks which might put its own life in peril. But within those boundaries, they let the calf do what it wants, have fun, and learn, make mistakes. You know, sometimes maybe get a little bit hurt, doesn't matter what, they still let them do that. Now, this is how they were brought up. And that is the reason why these lessons were learnt, and they were learnt in such a wonderful, practical way, which remained lifelong. Like nobody needed to teach that lesson a second time. The lesson was learnt very well. Now, the challenge for us today in teaching Islam, and now again, before I come to that, the Rasulullah ﷺ also taught in this way. Right, children, the individuals, the Sahaba who he taught were individually important to him. He spent time on each one of them personally, and other senior Sahaba spent time on them, on the junior ones. So each Sahabi had multiple teachers, and again, all done in a matter-of-fact way while going through their daily jobs and work and social life and so forth. All of these things, corrections were done, reinforcement was done, praise was given, they were applauded, and they were corrected. So this happened. Now the big challenge for us is that since we have created a schooling system that's the same, there's no differentiation between how we teach Islam and how we teach anything else. We teach all of those things in the same way, which is in a classroom, which is with one teacher, maybe two teachers, and multiple students, 15, 20, 30, even if you don't go all the way to 50 and 60 like they do in India, but you still 50, even 15 children, for example, 15 children, two teachers, you might say, well, you know, this is fantastic. Yes, it is compared to the other way, which is 50-60, but still, it's not the same as in one student with 2-3 teachers. Now, obviously, that is in practice not possible, because here you're talking about people who are paid to do what they do, and what we got in our families, all the people who took the trouble to train us and to spend time on us were people who were not paid for that. Right? These are people who did that out of love, right? And they did that. They did what you wanted them to do, and they did it out of affection, without being paid. But we have the situation. So I think the thing is to see how we can partner with parents. That is the key thing. Partner with parents in such a way that at least the things that you're trying to achieve in the school get reinforced back home with proper parenting. Draw parents into the school also, for example. Get the parents to say, when you are free, just come to the school and sit in the class and be co-teachers. Now, you know, they might say, well, you know, you're paying the teacher, you're not paying me. Yeah, sure, the child belongs to you. is your child, not the teacher's child. So teacher will get paid, you will not get paid. This is your contribution to your own child and to the others, children of others, which is, you know, this is all part of the same game. We say need the whole village to raise one child. Obviously, the child is not related to everyone in the village, but the whole village is participating in raising that child because there is a there is a joint stake for everyone in the raising of that child. Everyone is involved. So you say, well, you know, I may not be my child, but I am raising another individual who is equally important for me and for all of us. So I think this is very important for us to keep in mind and say, how can we get parents involved in the raising of our children, so that, you know, we at least to some extent we measure, we mirror the goodness of tarbiyah that the Sahaba got. That's why the whole issue of tarbiyah, the sohba, the sohbat of elders, the importance of physical company of teachers. You know, there's we have lost so much that it's a struggle to even recall what we lost. But anyway, inshallah, as long as we keep working on it, there's always hope. Wa sallallahu ala nabiyyil kareem wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in bi rahmatika ya arhamar rahimin.